This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Last week of August, you think it'd be pretty calm, right? Yeah, think again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 30th of August, good as always to have you along, everybody. I am honestly not sure how much more you need in any given week than the Fed getting dragged into politics, another step up in the trade war, and economic growth coming in lower than people had expected. But we got all that this week, and even some more. So let's figure out what the what. Gina Smilek's at the New York Times. Kate Davidson's at the Wall Street Journal. They are both in our bureau in Washington. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Gina, let me start with you and the Fed and politics. Just to recap, Bill Dudley, the former president of the New York Federal Reserve, which is to say he was a big deal inside monetary policy in the Fed, came out with an op-ed this week in which he said, number one, the Fed should not enable President Trump's trade war. And he said in the last paragraph, which was really the kicker, look, Fed, I think you need to think about the 2020 elections when you're thinking about your policy stance. What do you think, Bill Dudley, who knows better than anybody the reverence of Federal Reserve independence, what was he thinking?
That is the question of the week among Fed watchers, to be honest with you. Yeah, I think, you know, up until that last paragraph, you kind of read it and it made sense with what others have said, with what analysts have said. You know, there is this feeling out on Wall Street that maybe the Fed is enabling this trade war, although the Fed itself likes to distance itself very much from that view. But then you get to that last paragraph and this idea that the Fed should be thinking about politics as it sets monetary policy. And that is just something completely divorced from what the Fed itself will tell you is the way it sets policy. Yeah. It very much focuses on inflation and employment.
And Chair Powell says every time somebody asks him about one of the president's tweets, Kate, he says, I'm going to do my job. And we've got, two things we're worried about, inflation and stable prices. Do you think, Kate Davidson, that Bill Dudley did harm to the Fed's independence? Because frankly, I'm waiting for a presidential tweet here. Honestly, I'm shocked we haven't seen it.
I am, too. And I think, frankly, it's hard to see how the op-ed helped the Fed in any way. I think that, right, the Fed is going to generally, and this happens anytime there's an economic downturn, the Fed usually gets blamed for it. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that, stepping back and refusing to, quote unquote, enable the trade war is going to really protect the Fed in some way from the economic harm that may come from the president's trade policy. Mm-hmm. So kind of the suggestion that that they shouldn't go along with it. As Gina said, I just think it sort of goes against the way that they set policy, which is to say, you know, fiscal policymakers, the administration, lawmakers, they make their decisions and that's their job. And that's separate from what we do. We make our decisions based on how the economy is doing and how the economy responds to that.
So really quickly, Gina, I wasn't going to go here, but I had Robert Kaplan from the Dallas Fed on the program on Wednesday, and we talked a little bit, he and I, about how, just to Kate's point about how the Fed always gets blamed, we need to have in this country more economic policy responses than just, oh, the Fed's going to fix this, right?
Yeah, and I think that's a sort of a common complaint you hear from central bankers around the world. This past week was the Jackson Hole meeting, you know, where bunch of these sort of big name central bankers get together in Wyoming and chat about monetary policy and all things economic. And just the common refrain you hear is, We need more fiscal support. Mm. People are too willing to rely on monetary policy to just save us from all of our economic woes. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't seem to have changed in the wake of the crisis.
All right. Let us turn now to sort of something else that's going on out there. And we're going to talk about this a little bit later in the program. But, Kate, I want to talk about the American consumer, who is, again and still, the American economy's lifeline. How much longer do you suppose consumers can keep that up?
Well, I think consumers, the outlook looks good for the rest of the year. But I think that one thing that is concerning some economists is actually, if you look on the corporate side, corporate profit growth was strong in the second quarter. We found that out this week in the latest update on GDP. But, they're only up about 1.7% from a year earlier, and economists project that could soften later in the year. So, and business investment has declined. So they're a little bit worried that could spill over to the consumer if companies start, if it weighs on hiring or if companies start laying people off. Right now, as you said, everything looks good, but there are a few reasons to be concerned.
Speaking of reasons to be concerned, Gina Smilak, in the last minute-ish that we have left, I have not yet heard the word trade war, I think, on the broadcast yet today, but more tariffs coming on Sunday, that's still going on.
Right. I mean, yeah, and certainly a reason to be concerned. So Chad Bohn at the Pearson Institute has been putting out these really great updates, just sort of tracking how much tariffs have gone up over time. And as of Sunday, I think it's going to be something like 21% tariff overall on imports from China, up from around 3% when the trade war started. So, this is just, it's been a real escalation, and it's kind of happened over time. It's been a little bit like boiling a frog.
Right.
But at the end of the day, this is starting to matter to U.S. businesses. And I think the real concern is these more recent tranches, more recent sort of iterations of tariffs are much more on consumer products than the previous rounds were. And so that's going to matter because it's going to force these consumer companies that don't have a lot of pricing power to begin with to decide whether they're going to lift prices and hurt consumers or whether they're going to take it on sort of the profit side.
Right, which we will also hear about later in the program. One last thing about those tariff levels. Not only are the Chinese raising overall tariff levels on us, they are lowering them on other people. So there's a lot to keep your eye on. Gina Smilak at the New York Times, Kate Davidson at the Wall Street Journal in Washington for us on this Friday before three-day weekend. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wall Street, as I said, on a Friday in front of a three-day weekend, kind of a wash, actually. Maybe the algorithms left town early. I don't know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so Sunday, as I said a couple of minutes ago, is the latest trade war turning point. President Trump's next round of tariffs on Chinese imports kicks in 15% on a 122-page long list of items, including
original sculptures and statuary in any material, postage or revenue stamps, stamp postmarks, first day covers, postal stationery and the like, used or unused, other than heading 4907. Collections and collector's pieces of zoological, botanical, mineralogical, anatomical, historical, archaeological, etc. interest. Antiques of an age exceeding 100 years.
People collect a lot of things, and one of the things people collect is certainly antiques, and amongst those, they certainly collect Chinese antiques, maybe more of your grandma's generation, but people, liked fancy china in the past.
Peter Tompa is a lawyer, also the executive director of the Global Heritage Alliance. You ask him, importers aren't going to want to pay 15% up front to consign something from China that they want to sell here.
I think it's going to be a real drag on the ability of antiquities dealers to get consignments from abroad.
There's a technicality with Chinese antiques as well, Tompa says, because most of the Chinese antiques that we collect here don't come directly from China because China has put export controls on a lot of them.
So a lot of the material that we actually collect here in the United States comes from places like Britain or Japan, where it's also widely collected. So it's still, the tariff is still going to be collected on it because the country of origin is China, but the material has been out of China for, decades in most instances.
Which means, Tompa says, there's really no net effect on China from these tariffs, all of which is to say, if you're going antiquing this weekend, go Saturday, not Sunday. If you happen to have missed yesterday's broadcast on the radio, we did a whole lot more of these tariff explainers, English accent and all. You can catch up with the Marketplace podcast, available, of course, wherever fine podcasts are offered. Talked about this a little bit with Gina and Kate, the yeoman's work y'all are doing, y'all being consumers, of course, holding this economy up right now. More evidence of that today. The Commerce Department reported a solid increase in consumer spending last month, up 0.6%. So nice job. Where the cash for all that spending is coming from, though, that matters, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains.
Consumer spending is fueling economic growth, even as businesses pull back on investments. But more spending isn't, by itself, always a good thing.
Prior to the Great Recession, a lot of consumers and households were using credit as the main means of financing their outlays.
Gregory Dacko of Oxford Economics says, unlike back then, today,
what we're seeing is consumer spending growing more and more in line with real disposable income growth.
He says people are mostly spending within their means. At the same time, credit card delinquencies are on the rise, and overall consumer debt is at more than $13 trillion, including mortgage and student loan debt. That's about a trillion more than just before the Great Recession. Marielle Beasley, co-founder of the Common Sense Lab, studies consumer behavior. She says the solid job market and low interest rates lure people into borrowing more than they should.
People taking on more and more debt, whether that be sort of mortgage debt or credit card debt or car loan debt. A lot of that is people will borrow up to the amount that somebody will give them.
As long as unemployment remains low and wages rise, people can spend and probably manage all right. But, says Mark Hamrick, a senior economic analyst at Bankrate.com,
one thing that we do need to keep in mind is that expansions do not last forever. And at some point, we will have an economic downturn, which is another way of saying a recession.
And it's at that point, he says, that having a lot of debt can become a lot more problematic. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Since the early 90s, I think that we've been engaged in a grand experiment.
Now a grand global experiment, big tech and the regulation thereof. Straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 41 points today, about a 0.1%, 26,403. The Nasdaq dropped 10 points, 0.1% there as well, 79.62. S&P 500 gained a point, we'll call that flat, 29.26. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow added just over 3%. Nasdaq up 2.6%. The S&P 500 improved 2.8%. Boeing gained 0.3% today, even though United Airlines announced today it's pulling Boeing 737 MAX from its schedules till December. Remember, that plane still cannot fly. Bond prices fell just a tad. The yield on the 10-year T-note remains at 1.49%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Back to the harmonized tariff schedule we go. The list of things the Trump administration is going to slap 15% import taxes on starting Sunday at 12:01 a.m. That list includes bovine carcasses and halves, fresh or chilled, milk protein concentrates, safety pins, and thumbtacks. Also,
fish hooks, snelled. Fish hooks, not snelled. Fishing reels valued over $8.45 each. Parts and accessories for fishing reels. Fishing line put up and packaged for retail sale. Fishing casts or leaders. Sailboards. Parts and accessories for sailboards. Water skis, surfboards, and other water sport equipment other than sailboards, and parts and accessories thereof.
So it's going to get a little bit pricier to spend a day on the water.
We rely on a global supply chain, and it's definitely impacted the boating industry.
That's Nicole Vassalera. She's from the National Marine Manufacturers Association.
Much of the fishing equipment is imported from China.
And here's the real question then for this whole tariff thing that President Trump's got going on.
Every manufacturer is going to have to make their choice and make a decision of whether that's going to be passed directly on to the consumer. But understanding that there's only so much time and money out there.
A quick shout out one more time to the voice of the harmonized tariff schedule the past couple of days for us, our foreign editor, John Buckley. At some point, the 2020 campaign season notwithstanding, Congress is going to get back to the question of regulating the tech industry. There have been hearings already, yes, and some agencies, the Federal Trade Commission, for instance, has opened an antitrust investigation into Facebook. But so far, more talk than action. I mention that because I did a panel last month at Fortune Magazine's Brainstorm Tech Conference up in Aspen, Colorado. Topic du jour for the hour-long discussion? Yes, regulation of big tech. Specifically, should big tech be regulated? Five people on the panel all told: Elizabeth Banker from the Internet Association, that's a lobbying group, Diane Katz from the conservative think tank The Heritage Foundation, Takedra Mawakana from Waymo, that's Alphabet's self-driving car company, Corinne McSherry from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, that's a digital civil rights group, and Luigi Zingales from the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. All right, here you go.
I'm going to change the question that we're asking in this session. It's not how should technology be regulated. It's when it's going to be regulated. It's not should technology be regulated, rather. It's how and when. Let me start with Elizabeth Banker from the Internet Association. Test my premise here. Is this the right conversation to have? Not should, but when and how.
The Internet Association represents internet companies from the smallest to the largest, and there's one thing that they all agree on is that there is an urgent need for federal privacy legislation. And the reason that we feel this way is that there is a lack of clear guardrails for companies to follow and for consumers to know and understand. And overall, this impacts consumer trust, but it also impacts and creates business uncertainty and can impact innovation.
Diane Katz from Heritage, it's a coming, yes or no?
I hope not. I mean, I'm not going to give in to the premise that you presented because I certainly am one that's going to continue to fight against the idea that there should be regulation. Since the early 90s, I think that we've been engaged in a grand experiment with the internet, and it's completely outpaced the adaptive capacities of our social, political, and economic institutions. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that we now are talking about handing to them control for some of the issues that have arisen during this grand experiment. Bureaucracies are neither impartial and they're not altruistic. The fact is, Facebook would love regulation. Google would love regulation because it creates hurdles to new entrants and it really undermines the evolution of the market.
So, Diane, let's hold it there with the competition thought because I'm going to get to Luigi in a second and I'll return to you on the merits of this case. I want to get, though, to Takedra Mawakana. Waymo, subsidiary of Alphabet.
Yes.
Just recently, as we heard yesterday, got permission to operate autonomous taxi cabs in California. Talk to me about regulation. It's coming. Do you want it or don't you?
So I find myself somewhere between the first two responses.
That's a good place to be.
As a self-driving technology company, we were born 10 years ago. We wouldn't exist if this was a space that was regulated 10 years ago. The reality is the innovation is born where there's a lack of heavy-handed regulation. That said, the automotive industry is deeply regulated, and so we actually straddle both. And because of that, we actually think it's really important to figure out how to engage in these conversations early and responsibly. 10 years ago, companies were like, I'm going to ignore DC as long as I can. 5 years ago, companies were like, I'm going to ignore DC as long as I can. So I think we're seeing this evolution in companies now wanting to figure out how to engage responsibly with regulators. And certainly that's the case with Waymo.
Corinne McSherry, Electronic Frontier Foundation, Civil Liberties Online, yay or nay? Regulations come and get used to it.
So regulations come and get used to it. That's for sure. But I think a couple caveats to that. I think it's really important to focus on what kind of regulation we're talking about. There's a reason why the Internet Association and many other companies are suddenly excited about federal privacy rules. And that's because a few states have put in place state, strong state privacy rules. And folks are not happy about that. So suddenly Everyone is interested in federal regulation in a way that they never were before. And I think privacy rules are actually important and long overdue and necessary. And I think if there's a federal law that's as good as the state laws, great. We'll see what happens. But I share with the Heritage Foundation and many, many others a deep concern about federal overreach and regulatory overreach. Federal regulators are often not particularly good at it. And so we have a deep concern about that. And the other thing that we need to be careful of, is not trying to put in place rules that are sort of one size fits all, because there are going to be many regulations that might make sense for Facebook or Google or for giants that are just going to stifle the next Facebook.
Excellent, Corinne. Thank you. So let's go to Luigi Zingales from the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. Address those two points that Corinne and Diane Cass from Heritage made about competition in this marketplace and regulation's effect. You write on this a lot about the effects of concentration in these big tech companies, the power and political oomph that they have. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I think when we talk about regulation, the question is which regulation, because some regulation can be pro-competitive. Think about number portability of your cell phone. This is not a choice of the cell phone providers. It's something that was imposed by regulation, something that increased dramatically competition. And if you look around the world, places that have number portability have lower prices and at least as good quality. So it's a net benefit for consumers. So what we want is think about how can we increase competition in this sector, because even on privacy, competition can be a solution. If you have an alternative, you are under pressure to produce a better condition for your consumers.
So that was, I guess you'd say, the digest version of what the panelists had to say about what tech regulation is or ought to be. Wouldn't be a panel discussion, of course, without audience questions. The first one came courtesy of Fortune's own Adam Leshinsky.
I think this meme that regulators are not able to regulate is bull.
Wait, we can curse here?
We are allowed to curse here.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's what you said,
okay,
right? Right.
All right.
And so I would like some of you who feel that way to address that, please.
So let's, Diane Katz, go ahead.
You're wrong.
Why?
No, come
why,
on, Diane,
why,
more,
why?
More.
Why? Why? Stand up if
okay,
you can.
So
I understand you've got an
issue. We have decades worth of experience in what the consequences of regulation are. I'm not arguing that they can't regulate. Of course they can regulate. They regulate tons of things all the time. The question is, what are the consequences of that regulation and what are the costs of those regulations? And my point here is that users, us, the public, because of the internet in particular, are much more powerful and effective as a force for change than government will ever be. And to impose a 20th century regulatory model on a 21st century market risks turning regulation into strictly a political exercise because there's no law undergirding it.
Excellent. Thank you. Yes, ma'am, right there. Please stand up and tell us who you are.
Carla Monteroso, CEO of Code 2040. I mean, we're outsourcing American infrastructure to a bunch of private companies right now. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad that they got there first, but American infrastructure definitely needs to catch up. And the fact of the matter is that for the big five, you have companies that have more power than nation states there. And we have our own legislative bodies not understand how to interact with that and come to hearings less prepared than they would for a hearing on China. So I cannot wrap my brain around how we are going to look at that gap between our American infrastructure and say, well, then these private companies are going to make private decisions around American public policy.
Tikka, could you take that one, would you, as the representative of private companies here in this sure. economy?
I think that's a really interesting point. The question of whether it's been outsourced, the sort of U.S. infrastructure, I mean, it has been outsourced to companies. But that innovation wouldn't have happened with the government at the helm. And so one of the things that's most important now, representing Waymo, on a self-driving technology company, is we're nascent and we're doing all three of these. We're engaging with regulators at the federal, state, and internationally. We are engaging with consumers, Because the reality is they're the ones deciding that the status quo isn't good enough, right? 40,000 people dying on the roads every year. We're pretty immune to at 100 a day in the U.S. We're pretty immune to that issue. That's an actual value proposition that causes people to say, oh, if you can use my data to help me get from point A to point B, that isn't something my elected official can figure out without you, Waymo. At the same time, we need policymakers to recognize they're there to represent the constituents, and the constituents define the value proposition. And right now, to me, what we're seeing is this reset. You know, 10 years ago, people thought social media was actually worth the value proposition. Now, maybe we've aged out of it, but whatever it is, people have reevaluated the value proposition of that, and there isn't actually a way in the legislative process to get those voices back into the loop.
So that was the Fortune Brainstorm Tech Conference up in Aspen about six-something weeks ago. Like I said, the whole conversation went an hour. We talked about hate speech, among a bunch of other things. Also, whether big tech companies ought to just be broken up. I will also commend to your attention the full video of that panel, which we've got at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, just because I love it so much, and who knows when I'm just going to get to read aloud from the harmonized tariff schedule again, right? So, the list of stuff that goes into effect this weekend is technically called List 4A, 15% tax on about $150 or so billion dollars worth of stuff that we import from China. List 4B goes into effect December the 15th. That'll be everything else we import from China that's not already tariffed. So, from List 4B, a random sample for your pre-Christmas tariff pleasure. Breadboards, chopping boards, chopsticks, forks, and spoons of bamboo, live mushroom spawn, garden umbrellas, electrothermic hair dryers. I could go on all day. Our trade correspondent Tracy Samuelson once told me, every tariff schedule tells a story. All right, we are out of here. Dow Industrial is up 41 points today, about a 10%. NASDAQ down 10, a 10%. S&P 500 basically flat. For the week, though, pretty good day, pretty good week, rather, all the way around on Wall Street. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are gone for the long weekend. If you're working, thank you. If you're not, enjoy yourself. We're back on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.